Southern Vanguard Radio. This is DJ John Doe. Hi. And to the left of me is my man,
Eddie Meeks. What's good, people? Man, another week.
You notice that oomph I'm putting behind that
shit?
Yeah,
man. Yeah, yeah. People love it, man.
It's famous. I gotta spice it up and shit now, you know?
Nothing wrong with that, man. What's good, homie?
You know, it is a brisk 40-some-odd degrees outside right now, which is pretty damn cold for Atlanta.
Hell and yeah, gotta love it.
In though. November. Well,
gotta love it.
Last week, I think, my son was in shorts. Mm. He walked out of the house today. He was in shorts. I'm like, nah, dude, it's 45 degrees outside, man. You got to put some pants on, man. At a minimum, pants and a long sleeve shirt, right, at a minimum.
Right.
And then he came back inside like 15 minutes later and got his toboggan.
Oh, okay.
I was like, yeah, you're tough now, huh?
For real, yeah.
Yeah, you're tough now.
Yeah, man. Yeah, this is my season right here. I'm ready.
The fall and the winter is the shit.
Yes, it is.
So let's see, real quick, before we get to our guests, this is an interview session. But for those of you who don't know, a lot of folks listen to the interview only. We actually have a mixed show that drops on Tuesdays. So when you wake up on Tuesday, you're going to get about an hour and a half of all brand new, fresh, for lack of a better term, underground hip hop and rap. And then we'll usually provide a preview of the interview that's to come on Thursday. So we drop twice a week.
Yes.
And let's see. Tonight, Meeks, this is you. You set this up. I won't let you introduce this one.
Well,
because I'm really, this is an honor, actually, to have her on the podcast.
That's an understatement, yo. just real quick. I've been following this young lady for quite some time. I thought I was going to actually get to bump into her in my hometown of Memphis, Tennessee. I got word that she was living out there at one point, but it was on some secret squirrel type shit.
Oh, okay.
So I never saw her. And at one point I was like, man, Wendy Day ain't out here, man. Y'all lying. And I never made that happen. But you know, talking to John, and we trying to wrap this year up real strong.
Yes, sir.
And not to sound sexist or anything, but tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have our first female interviewee.
Yes.
And
sir,
it is quite an honor. And we're talking to the one and only Wendy Day.
Wow.
Shotgun Wendy. Salute.
Hi, guys.
What's Wendy, up? How are you?
I'm great. I want to be Inspector Gadget instead of Secret Squirrel.
Okay, we'll change that. We'll change that to Inspector Go-Go Gadget. Because I was like, Wendy Day is in Memphis? I was like, there's no way.
Yes.
There's
I
no
was
way.
There from 2003 until 2006.
Okay.
So while we're on that topic, Wendy, what were you doing around that time period in Memphis?
Chilling.
Good for you.
I actually left New York. I found that I hit like 40 years old, and I felt like I was living like a college student. Because in New York, you've got to be really rich to be able to have like some kind of lifestyle.
Absolutely.
So I hit 40 years old, and I was living in a loft apartment with 5 DJs. And it just got to the point where it was like, okay, it's time for me to be an adult now.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened Map of the United States, and this is a true story. I closed my eyes, and I spun the map around, and I stuck my finger down, and it landed in Memphis.
Wow.
And I have never even been to Memphis. And I said, well, this is cool. It'll put me sort of in the center of the U.S. so I can get to L.A. in a couple hours. I can get to New York in a couple of hours, and I can, you know, be an adult. So this was in June of 2003. I had just done David Banner's deal at Universal.
Okay. Yeah.
And I said, you know, I'm moving on up. So off I went to Memphis, and it was Father's Day when I arrived there with my belongings in a truck.
Wow.
And I said, you know what? It won't take me that long to find a place. And I was amazed because, you know, when you're used to New York rent.
Yeah.
And you're used to spending like $1,500 for a 10-by-12 room.
You was balling in Memphis.
$1,500. I got a 5-bedroom house with a pool.
Yeah.
And it was like when I found it, I thought it was such a big deal that I like quick paid 6 months rent up front. So I moved in immediately, and I said, okay, this is great. And I had never had, I shouldn't say never, but you know, in my music industry life, I never had so much room to move around. I had a swimming pool. I didn't make more money, but I felt like I was making more money because it was so much cheaper.
Right. Yeah. Cost of living was awesome. Nothing. Yeah.
I know what it was.
And I lived
really
there for 3 years.
I know what it
was. I
was
on the music commission and everything. Like, I really got involved in the community. It was awesome. Memphis is a great city.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, with it being so culturally rich and music-wise. That had to be a perfect situation for you.
It was. Yeah. It was. The problem for me was it was like a three-year vacation because I couldn't make money there. It's like the music industry is so guarded and so fucked up in Memphis that, like, I was great at giving seminars. Once a month I did seminars at the New Daisy Theater.
Yeah.
And I would have turnouts from 100 to 300 people, depending on what the topic was. So it was great for me to educate up-and-coming artists, but I couldn't find investors there to put money into the artists so that they could get their product, like, out into the marketplace.
Right.
And I've never seen a city like that where the people with money didn't want to help the artists move forward, you know?
So,
and I got really frustrated. There were some artists there who were like crabs in a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
There were some artists there who are pretty established that were just jerking artists left and right.
Yeah.
And it was just ugliness. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to move to either Atlanta or Houston.
Gotcha.
So in 2006, I was trying to pick one or the other, and I chose Atlanta, and I'm glad I did because Atlanta has really boomed since I've been here.
Okay.
So, Meeks, that eerily sounds like pretty much every story you've told me about the music industry
look,
in Memphis,
homie,
Tennessee.
I have no reason to lie to anyone.
No.
I have been out of the city of Memphis since 89. So
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
I mean, and
I get it.
And you compare what we've been able to do here musically, John, I just think about, I would have never been able to do any of that shit in Memphis, dude.
Yeah, but even in 03, huh, Wendy?
It's not like it's not your fault. Like,
no.
It's not. The problem isn't the artist. The problem is the environment.
Exactly.
Of the city. It's just, it's very oppressive to people of color.
Yeah.
When I was on the Music Commission board, the guy who was running the Memphis Music Foundation was very insightful, and he was like at the forefront of trying to lead urban music to come. Like we had meetings with G-Unit to bring G-Unit south there. We had meetings with Jazzy Faye and Drumma Boy to bring them back to Memphis and start their own record label.
Right.
And we brought MTV in to see if we could do the MTV Awards one year in Memphis. Like, we did all these really cool things, and then the city, the elders of the city just kind of shut us down. It's like they didn't want to see black music move forward.
You want to know about a fucked up situation where the city almost came to blows was when they wanted to give the key to the city to 3-6 Mafia.
Mafia, I remember that.
Oh my God!
I
thought the mayor
then,
was gonna get. I thought the mayor was gonna get assassinated. I thought it was gonna be.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's crazy. I thought it was gonna be 1968 in Memphis. Yeah, and they get an Oscar, and now they dick riding, and you know it's
isn't that crazy?
It's ridiculous, man. But that's the city. I love that city. Don't get me wrong. A lot of people hear me talk about my hometown, and they think I'm a Memphis hater. It's not the thing. I just wish I could have done.
You just know what it could be.
Yeah, I just wish I could have done what I've done here in Atlanta in my hometown. But
exactly,
can't do it.
Exactly,
can't do it.
No. No, we got really close with David Banner.
Mm-hmm.
We met with the city. The city was going to lease him a building for $1 a year next to the FedEx Forum. Not next to the FedEx Forum, but like in that area.
In that area.
It was a building that was really run down that they couldn't lease. They couldn't do anything with it. And there was one older white gentleman on the commission with me who shut that down. He was new to the commission. And I thought he was my friend, and I was amazed. He went through Banner's songs, and Banner is a pretty positive guy,
yeah.
But he went through Banner's lyrics line by line for like 30 different songs and highlighted lyrics that he found offensive.
Wow.
And this guy was an accordion player.
That's
like he wasn't, you know, he wasn't even really like in the music industry. And this is the guy that got it all shut down And I remember the day he did that, it's like I was on a conference call with all these different other people on the music commission. They're like, well, maybe we should rethink this. And I'm like, wow, I just put 6 months of work into this. And we're going to build a community center for kids so they had someplace to go after school so that they could learn music. Banner was going to move to Memphis. He was going to run his label out of Memphis. And after we got off the phone, I just sat there at my desk and I said, wow, I'm going to have to fucking move. Yeah. And that was the day that I made the decision. And in July of 06, I came to Atlanta and never looked back.
Wow.
That's crazy because that would have popped. There, that would have
really
popped so hard, man. That shit would have been off the chain, man.
It
would have
been the biggest
awesome.
Thing. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That would have been huge.
It would have just been so great for the community and so great for kids. And,
yep. And
they
need that.
Downtown. So
they really
the south
need
side
that.
Would come, the north side would come.
Yep.
It was just the whole idea was awesome. Jazzy Faye was going to help us out. It was just such an awesome thing.
Yeah.
And one guy who just couldn't stand the idea of rap music getting and it's like the building is probably still empty to this day. It's not like it's not like they were giving him a building that they could rent or sell. You know, it was a building that was just in really bad disarray. He was going to come in and spend the money to renovate it. We were going to get Apple to donate computers and stuff. Like, we had this wonderful plan, and this one guy just lit a spark and just destroyed it.
Wow. That's awful.
That just goes in line. I mean, we're talking about a city that had a chance to have legalized gambling and betting, turn that shit down. You go 30 minutes.
Everything down.
If you go 30 minutes south, I believe, you can gamble your life away.
Yeah.
Yep. And they're getting all the money.
And they're getting all the proceeds
from it.
All
the
money.
And
then Memphis is having all the Gamblers Anonymous costs and stuff to deal with.
It's right, crazy. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And I'm surprised there's still baseball there. There's an NBA team that's actually decent. You know what I'm saying? All that surprises me because historically they turn down opportunities left and right. It's crazy.
Yes,
that's just so weird, too, with, like, such a rich history in black music, period. I mean, from Stax and all that shit.
Well,
like,
that's just it.
That just doesn't make any sense.
I think they're stuck in that to the point where they still want to make blues and R&B the front runner. And don't forget about your man on the street named after him, Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they're trying to keep all that shit alive.
That's part of the problem.
And I throw a middle finger up at Graceland every time I'm at home, man.
I don't even go near it.
I didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. I grew up 5 minutes away from that place. I went to high school.
I
went to high school on Elvis Presley Boulevard and all that. So I would see all that shit. And every time, you know, my mom would try to strangle me because I got my finger out the window. He's like, you don't do that type. I'm like, man.
Oh, that's funny.
Come on. Yeah. That's hey, hilarious. Wendy, did you actually broker any deals for any artists in Memphis while you were there?
No.
Okay. Because I thought maybe you had some dealings with Kia Shine at one point.
Nope. I wouldn't work with Kia.
Okay. All right. Cool.
So Wendy, there's a trillion things that we could ask you, but I think the one that I kind of wanted to start. I don't want to talk about like all the just like the typical stuff because I'm sure you get the same questions asked a lot. But
I do.
Would you mind giving us a little bit of history of, I guess, your background, like how you got into music and how you eventually kind of came to the place that you'd like to be? Because I don't hear or see that a lot when I see articles or interviews about you. It always seems to be about cash
deals.
Money this or the deals or whatever, but I mean we
but
really
nobody
like,
ever wants to know like what got me there, like
why am I
doing those kind of deals.
Yeah, so can you start,
and it's kind of important.
It's very important.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So I don't know where you want to start. I mean, a lot of times you're like,
well, let me start at the beginning.
Okay, cool. All right,
let's go in order if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
And I'll try to keep it lively so that your eyes don't glaze over. But I started listening to rap in 1980, which is when I graduated from high school. Rap, I was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at the time. And as you know, rap started in New York. It started in the Bronx. And cassette tapes used to make their way from New York down to Philly. And I fell in love with the music. I loved the passion and the energy of it. The very first introduction I had to rap was Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I saw them live at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia.
Oh, shit.
And I was in love. I was struck by just the energy of the music. So fast forward to 1992. I stayed a fan all those years. I worked in corporate America. I made a bit of money, which back then was my goal. Uh-huh. Realized that making money didn't make me happy, and I decided that I wanted to do something to help folks. My okay. undergraduate degree is in art. I have a master's degree in African American studies from Temple University, and I've got a master's degree I have an MBA in
okay.
marketing.
Wendy, I'm gonna jump in real quick. I'm gonna let you finish because I'm gonna follow up with the question of your master's in African American mm-hmm. studies. But go ahead, go back.
Okay.
Yeah.
The thing about being a white person with a master's in AFAM studies, and I got it at Temple, which is an Afrocentric school. Dr. Malethi Asante runs the program there. So that's even like a deeper layer than just African American studies, mm-hmm. right? So basically, I was qualified to either teach or write, and I didn't want to do either. So when I decided to leave corporate America, I wanted to do something to help people. I knew that I wanted to be in the not-for-profit sector. I knew that I wanted to own my own nonprofit, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And at that point in time, my thinking was to help people of color start businesses because I had read a lot in terms of getting my master's, and I had studied Elijah Muhammad, and he was talking about how entrepreneurialism is the key to everything, that in farming and a bunch of other shit that he talked about. But I believe that too. I believe that if people start their own businesses and they're not beholden to a paycheck, that they can empower themselves and they can go as far as they choose to go. So if they want to go really become really wealthy, they can. If they want, you know, if they don't want to, if they just want to feed their family and sort of have a comfortable living, they can choose to do that. So if you have control of your own career and your own future, you kind of have control over your own little section of the world, your family, right. your house, your home, your everything.
Yeah.
So I knew that I wanted to help people start businesses, but I didn't quite know how to do that or what I wanted to do. And I took a class in New York at the New School. And the New School is a very open, left-leaning university, and they had a class there in pop music, and it was taught by an accountant to the stars. His name is Burt Cadell, and Burt taught this class about pop music, but he happened to be the accountant for a ton of rappers that I respected, you know, and not just rappers, but like the top stars of the day, which at that time were Luther Vandross, Madonna, Albie Shore. Mm-hmm. He handled Puffy and all of his all of his artists. You know, Burt was kind of the guy who was the center of the kind of music that I liked.
Right.
And he was this little old white Jewish man. He was probably in his 60s then. And you know, I went to him after class one night and I said, you know, I want to work in the music business. I love rap music and I want to do something to help rappers because they've given me so many years of happiness with this music. I want to do something to give back. And he was telling me how abused rappers are in the music industry. And I said, yeah, that's what I'll do. I'll start an organization to help these guys when they're not profitable anymore and they're stuck in bad deals. I will help them get out of their deals. Like, I'll introduce them to lawyers to break the contracts. And he's like, well, why would you want to do that? There's no money in altruism. And it kind of fucked my head up when he said that, because it's like, wow, you're part of the problem, not the solution.
Right.
You know, and he's, you know, he's a good man. He's done what he could do in the music industry. But it just kind of fucked me up that his attitude was, if you can't get 5% of somebody, it's not worth helping them. You move on to somebody that has money. And I never understood that philosophy. I still don't to this day, you know,
so,
23 years later, I still don't get it.
So Wendy, were you raised in a family that was, very involved in, you know, altruism or philanthropy?
No.
Or I mean, like, what?
No.
So,
no.
Where does that come from?
Very lower middle class family.
Okay.
My mom stayed home and took care of my sister and I. My dad, when you go to the post office to buy stamps, my dad is the guy at the window at the post office that would sell you those stamps.
Okay.
So we came from pretty meager means. We lived in a wealthy Jewish neighborhood. We were not wealthy. We were not Jewish. So from a young age, I was always kind of an outsider. I never fit in.
Okay.
So I was comfortable in not fitting in.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, like it was my comfort zone.
Sure.
To, you know, as it were. So when I started working in the music industry as a white person within Black culture, I was comfortable.
So what about the music bit? So what about the music bit then? Were your parents or your brothers or sisters or any family members really into music, or was that just something you naturally gravitated as well?
It was just something I naturally gravitated towards. Like, I don't remember growing up and listening to music in the house. My parents didn't really listen to music.
Okay.
Every now and again, my dad would listen to Frank Sinatra. But I remember as a kid, like, when we would go on long drives, my dad would be listening to the baseball game. He was a baseball head.
Oh, okay.
So
gotcha.
I remember hearing baseball more than anything. But when I hit maybe like my preteens, like 11, 12, I remember getting a radio for Christmas, and I tied it to my bicycle handlebars. And everywhere I went, I would have music playing.
Yeah.
So I loved music as a child, but I didn't, and that was rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't grow up in a musical family at all.
Gotcha. Okay.
I played the piano as a kid, but I hated practicing, so that didn't last long.
Course,
I tried playing the violin in school. I didn't like practicing. That didn't last long.
So did you have any friends that were into hip-hop and rap as much as you were, or were into the culture, or you were just out
Not
there on
all.
An island by yourself? Like,
yeah. But remember, I grew up in a world where I was an island by myself, so that wasn't uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird.
Right.
Okay.
You know, I fit in because I didn't fit in my whole life. So
I
never minded being the only one. You know, like, I can go to the movies by myself. I can go to dinner by myself. I'm not uncomfortable being just me or just with me.
Okay.
You know,
gotcha.
Which is kind of a blessing when you think about it.
Absolutely.
So I started Rap Coalition, and I started pulling people out of bad deals by introducing them to attorneys that were really powerful. Bert was very helpful in terms of introducing me to attorneys that worked with, like, Madonna and Luther Vandross. So these guys had enough income that they could work a couple of pro bono projects, and it wasn't a problem.
Okay.
So they were very, as long as I brought the artist to them and they didn't have to go and find them, they were happy to help. And,
interesting.
You know, when I first started the company, and actually for the whole, you know, the 23-year history, not only do we not charge for this service, but we also don't, like, you'll never see press on the fact that I pulled Common off of Relativity or Kill a Priest off of Geffen. Like, I'm not in your face about the different artists that I've helped pull off of labels and pull out of bad deals. And I think a lot of the reason why the labels tolerate me, I think it's twofold. I think because I never really publicized the bad side of labels.
Right.
And I never really talked about, like, what I was doing. I always just did it very quietly.
Right.
And then on the flip side, I was bringing them talent and negotiating good deals. Because remember, I was seeing all the bad contracts.
Right.
So I knew what to ask for in a good deal because I had seen so many fucked up deals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to say, okay, now I'm going to get these guys that you want who are selling music on their own and building their own buzz and the ones that have leverage. I'm going to get them into some stellar deals. And the labels made a shit ton of money. You know, I did Eminem's deal and Cash Money and No Limit and David Banner and Twista. So, you know, there's so many artists that I've worked with over the years that the labels have made hundreds of millions of dollars off of. So it's like, if I come to them and say, okay, I brought you Eminem, I brought you, you know, whoever, but Killer Priest isn't really doing well. He's kind of struggling here at your subsidiary, which is Geffen. You know, can we negotiate a release for him? you know, they were very apt to say, yeah, you know, if he's not happy, we're not happy. We don't want to just keep him and hold him. So, yeah, let's negotiate his release. Let's let him go.
So was there something in your corporate background that helped you here as well, Wendy? Where did the skill of negotiation come from?
And it's such a simple thing that helped me. I was selling advertising for Time and Newsweek, and I hated it. I hated sales because there was always there's always a number at the end of the month that I had to hit. And I always hit it. Well, I didn't always hit it, but I most often hit it. I was able to, you know, win the different awards that you get when you're in sales and the bonuses. And that part of it I liked, but the stress level, like the stress that it put on me to have to hit those quotas was just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So I got out of sales and started working in marketing. This is before I started Rap Coalition. I started working for a liquor company in Montreal. And it was the father of the guy that I was dating was from Montreal. It was the father of his best friend. And he hired me to move to Montreal and run his liquor company. He would fund it and then I would run it. And I thought that sounded like a really great deal. I made a shit ton of money doing that. And I really had fun. Like, I really enjoyed it for about 3.5 years. And then it wasn't fun anymore. And I told him I wanted to go back to New York. I had broken up with the guy I had been dating. That didn't work out very well. In fact, it worked out really badly. Okay. Who knew? Who knew that just like moving in with somebody that you only knew for 6 months would kill the relationship? Who knew?
That's unbelievable. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I had to marry him to get into the country, which made it even worse.
Oh, Jesus.
It was just, oh, God, it was a friggin' nightmare. You know, I used to take classes so that I wouldn't kill him, you know, like just to stay out of the house. You know, I took whatever classes they had on Saturdays and Sundays at the local university, and, you know, they had like bullshit classes. I learned to speak Russian. I learned how to make baskets. I learned pottery. Like, I was just taking classes so that I wouldn't be, you know, at home, because when I was at home, I would argue with him, you know, terribly.
Wow.
Underwater basket weaving, right?
Underwater basket weaving. Yeah, I got an A. It was great. But that, you know, that was my life. And then I wanted to come back to New York. Like, I just didn't want to do it anymore. It wasn't fun. And right about that time, Seagram's had offered to buy the company. And when a company like Seagram's offers to buy your company, you have a choice. You can either sell it and get, like, a fair price, or you can tell them no and watch them put you out of business over the next six to nine months.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. And crush it. Yeah. So when I told him that I wanted to go home anyway, it made perfect sense for him to sell. And I realized that a company that he started with a $100,000 investment turned into a $7 million company.
Wow.
And that's what I learned. I learned that I can do this. Like, fuck, I can do this. I can run a company. I can be successful. I don't need to work a sales job at Time Warner in order to make a lot of money. Like, I can be an entrepreneur and I can make money, and it's not hard. It's just work. It's putting systems in place and following those systems. And the most important thing is follow through.
Right.
And, you know, I'd say like 90% of the people out here have great ideas, but they just don't follow through.
Yeah, it's execution. Right. Absolutely. Yes. There's no doubt about it.
Execution, you know, and if it starts to go wrong, you just tweak it until it starts to go right. And I just, that's what I learned. So you asked me what, you know, what did corporate America teach me that I brought to the music industry? And that's it. You know, basically the deals that I've done were based on me following through, sending music to the record companies, building relationships, and calling them afterwards and following up and, you know, doing what you're supposed to do when you're in business, mm-hmm. you know, returning phone calls, that kind of crap.
Right.
And on top of that, I was building a reputation with artists that I was trustworthy in an industry that never has been trustworthy. So artists that were popping, you know, guys like Eminem that were really, really, really talented could come to me and build up enough leverage to make them attractive to a major label mm-hmm. and then get a deal. And they knew that when I was negotiating the deal that it was the best deal for them, not the best deal for their lawyer, not the best deal for their manager. but the best deal for them as an artist.
Right.
And once I did it for one person, which was Twisted, my first deal was actually No Limit, but I was part of a team. My first deal that I did myself was Twista. And once other artists saw what a great deal Twista had, they were like, well, I want one too. Mm-hmm. So they started coming and seeking me out.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that was actually going to be the next question that I asked was, what was the first deal, or what was the first, I guess, moment where you're like, oh shit, this is going to work.
Yeah.
Like, this is really going to go.
No Limit.
Okay.
No Limit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. No Limit.
So it wasn't necessarily the Twista deal.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It wasn't the Twista deal then. The Twista deal was like the first deal, but the No Limit deal was like, oh, all right, I've definitely got something here.
Yes. The No Limit deal came to me because I had pulled a guy in New York off of what was the label? Zoo was the name of the label. The group was called The Chameleons, spelled with a K. And The Chameleons, I had tried to renegotiate their deal. I had tried to write a marketing plan for the label because it was a rock label. They had Grace Jones and U2 and a bunch of other artists. And they just didn't understand rap. They wanted to work like rock, and you couldn't. Like, you still can't today. You know, it just doesn't work. And I wrote them a marketing plan. They didn't follow it. And finally, you know, everybody got frustrated, so they let the group go. And Popan, the half of the duo in the group, had a cousin out in Richmond, California, that was working with this artist, Master P, and they were negotiating, they were about to negotiate a deal with Priority Records, and EA Ski and his manager were involved in the deal, and they didn't trust Ski and his manager because Ski was signed to Priority. And they were a little concerned that an artist who was signed to the label might be using Master P as leverage in order to strengthen his own deal. And they just weren't sure. It turned out that Ski and his manager, whose name I have long forgotten, John something or other, it turned out that they were doing the right thing. But, you know, the guys were kind of nervous, so they asked me to take a look and get involved in the negotiations just to make sure they had somebody on their side who was really on their side. And that was a really cool deal to have as one of my first deals because it was a landmark deal. They owned their masters. It was just awesome, you know?
So,
and then from there, I went on to work with Do or Die and Twista in Chicago. Wow. They were the first records I ever helped put out. And I used, you know, I used two things, some stuff that I had learned from, you know, being part of Master P's world, because he is a marketing genius.
Right.
And I also used what I had learned at a convention in Baltimore. It was the independent label convention. And for the very first day, they had this seminar that went from like 9 to 6 that taught you how to put out a record. And I literally got on a plane after I left that convention and went to Chicago and rolled up my sleeves and just applied what I had learned, and it worked.
Was cool Keith teaching it? How the fuck you get a record deal?
Wouldn't that have been awesome?
Wendy, you said something that a lot of people would not even acknowledge, even if it would save their lives. You said that Master P was a marketing genius. No Limit deal that you brokered, was it the easiest deal? Because, I mean, it seemed like he had it on lock. It seemed like he had 100 releases under his belt before he released the first one.
Well, the deal was for 3 artists. It was, or 3 albums. It was Ice Cream Man, it was TRU, and it was Mia X. And forgive me, I don't remember the name of Mia X's album, her first album. But the deal was for 600,000, and it was for those 3 releases to come out first. And it was an 80-20 split, and he got to keep the masters solely because I don't think Brian Turner believed that there was any longevity in rap music or in master
or value, right?
You know?
So wait, so he just thought it was a quick hit? So he just thought it was going to be a quick hit and be one and done and be over with? And
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Or he thought it would be three and done and over with.
Well, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, when P walked in there, he had already sold like 300,000 CDs on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so he had leverage out the fucking ass.
Yeah.
The deal was a no-brainer.
Yeah,
and right. I knew how the guys on the West Coast were like fiending over him, no pun intended, because of fiend, but they were fiending over Master P. They loved the music, they loved the sound, and like this guy was buying bus benches to advertise on. You know, he was wrapping garbage trucks. Like he was just genius doing stuff that nobody else was doing. It was just, you know, it was unique and it was fresh and it was really cool.
Wow.
That's ill.
Yeah.
So Wendy, you mentioned...
What's funny is after I did that deal, it was around 95. And then I was working with Twista in 96. When I came back to New York and, you know, I had friends that worked at The Source, and I called The Source and I'm like, yo, you guys have to do a story about Master P. It's amazing what he's doing. And they're like, no. No. Yeah. It's garbage. No.
Right.
And it's just funny to me because once P blew up, and he had Make Him Say, oh,
yeah.
You know, that's really the song that blew him in New York. He was buying billboards in Brooklyn and doing shit in New York that, you know, nobody else had done before either. And right. then The Source couldn't, like, they were tripping over themselves to do an article on him. All of a sudden, you know, now that he was going to buy ads, he was like
wow.
a god. You know, it was crazy.
I got to say, other than probably the obvious, which is like Outkast and Goody Mob, that has to be the kind of milestone for Southern hip-hop and rap infiltrating
Homie,
New York, Cats the East Coast, and eventually
like,
the world.
Yo, Cats act like Master P and the whole No Limit movement yeah. did not change the game at that time. Yeah. And that's the shit that really fucks with
first.
Me. Nah, they wasn't the
like
first.
Yeah, like you said, Goody Mob and Outkast,
yeah.
and also Luke with Doo-Doo Brown.
Exactly.
Doo-Doo Brown.
Yeah.
Like, Flex used to play the shit out of that Miami-based booty
yeah.
shit.
And you bring up Uncle Luke. You can talk about Magic Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody that was going platinum in their region, you cannot front on that.
Yeah.
At
right.
all. You can't
right.
front on that. And that's what I'm saying. It's just like when you said he was a marketing genius, I really wanted you to speak to that because I think it goes without saying. And a lot of people just don't want to acknowledge it. That shit is crazy.
Well,
because
they didn't
me.
Like the music. And sometimes we get a little, we become assholes when we don't like the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guilty of that myself. Like, there's a lot of people that are successful that I just don't acknowledge because I don't like their music.
Oh, I'm
and I
definitely
think
guilty
that
of that.
That's what happened with P.
Yeah.
yeah.
Where, you know, he wasn't a New York lyricist. The music wasn't based in jazz the
right.
way, you know, the New York realists or purists thought mm-hmm. it should be. It wasn't backpack music. You know, it was just, and to a lot of people that believe that rap music should be conscious, you know, he's rapping about burner phones and
yeah.
flipping keys of cocaine
yeah.
and all sorts of shit
yeah.
that in New York made people's heads spin around.
Right.
You know?
So when...
But you couldn't ignore the streets. You couldn't ignore the fact that fans loved him. You know,
exactly.
you would buy an album and he would advertise the next three albums coming in the liner notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were dropping albums every 6 weeks, and I'm not exaggerating.
I got to tell you, so I was working in a record store in, let's see here, 90, that would have been 90, let's see here, 96, 97-ish or so.
Yeah, he burned out in 98, so
okay,
it had
yeah.
to be like 95,
yes.
96, 97.
So I worked at a record store in a mall. I worked at a Music Land, eventually Sam Goody, and... This is in the middle of Bowling Green, Kentucky, Wendy, and I have never
wow.
seen anything like that in my life. So, I mean, you know, you got the, you know, this is back when, you know, obviously record stores actually existed, But, you know, as soon as you walked into Music Land or Sam Goody, there on the left was like the top 10 or the top 20 wall, right? Mm-hmm. So I distinctly remember at one point, I think probably half of the top 20 on that wall was easily No Limit related.
No Limit.
You know, and like the shit that we sold a lot of, we had back behind us at the register because, you know, we had like the, you know, the theft preventative cases that they put around the CDs, you know, and shit. You know, mm-hmm. when you would, dude, I think at one point the entire back wall was nothing but No Limit releases. Yeah. That's all it was. It was insane.
I believe that. Yeah.
It was insanity. And this is like in, you know, nowhere Kentucky, right? I mean, the way that
exactly
the way that it permeated the nation was insane.
It was crazy, it was insane, man.
It was wild.
It was crazy.
It was like oral crack, you know?
Yeah, it really was.
I'm saying oral, not oral, right?
Yes.
I'm saying oral, like for your ears. And it was just like the movement was incredible. And if you look at it, like look at it from the business side and not the fan side, like when Priority Records wanted to sell an artist that wasn't on No Limit, they would put the Tank logo. They did it with Snoop. They did it with, what was Breed called? Damn, he's an artist out of Louisiana. I can't remember his name. Was it Breed?
I don't know.
Nah, Breed was MC.
It wasn't Breed. I'm thinking MC Breed.
Yeah.
I forget what his name was, but he was out of Louisiana, and he wasn't signed to No Limit, but Priority talked P into letting him put the logo on so that it would sell really well. And it did. His album did really well. You know, when they wanted to pull Snoop off of Death Row, they said, he signed to No Limit, but he wasn't. They just worked out a financial deal with No Limit to let him put the logo on it so that they'd sell more records.
That's
it was just, you know, genius.
Yeah, hold up. Snoop was never a No Limit artist.
He was down with No Limit, but he was physically signed to Priority. And if you looked at the liner notes, you really saw it.
Wow.
Like you saw the logo on the back of the album. He had the No Limit chain. He was out on tour with them. Beats by the Pound were making the music, but he was actually signed to Priority Records directly.
Wow.
So they did a money split instead of, you know, moving him over to No Limit and then having No Limit go through Priority.
Yeah, that was the stopgap, like after all the Death Row shit went down and Dre left and all that.
That was
when Snoop was trying to figure out all his shit. Exactly. Well, you know, I didn't see Boot Camp Click putting the No Limit Tank on the releases around that time.
That's true. He did not.
Oh, jeez. That's insane. So, Wendy, you mentioned something a little while ago. You were talking about getting Common off Relativity. How did that happen? How'd you get brought into something like that?
His manager, is his manager's name Derek?
I don't know.
Is it Derek? Dudley? I forget his name. I think that's his name. He reached out to me and he said that they were very frustrated. I sat down with Jim Cooperman, who was the head of, legal at Relativity. And, you know, they were frustrated too because they were trying to do right by Common. Common felt that he just wasn't getting the budgets that he was deserving of. But from Relativity's point of view, they had Bone Thugs and Harmony. They had Fat Joe. Mm-hmm. They had artists that were much more commercial that they were giving bigger budgets because they were selling more records.
Right.
And the way record labels work is, they figure out what they think you can sell financially, and then they figure out the most amount of money that they can put into you and make a decent profit for that amount of money. So if you're an artist who's only going to sell 100,000 CDs or 200,000 CDs, they're not going to give you the same budget as a group that they know will go gold or platinum.
Yeah, they back into it, right?
They back into it, like most corporations.
Right, yeah.
Well, a lot of artists feel that if they had bigger budgets that they would sell more. And unfortunately, you know, in business, that's not true. I understand why artists think that. They think that if you expose their music to every person in America, every person in America will buy that album. And that's just not the case. I understand that they think that, but it's just not true. And when you look at what was the label that Mos Def and Talib Kweli were signed
Raucous.
To?
Raucous.
Black Star was there.
Raucous.
Raucous, thank you. I don't know why I can't remember their name. Raucous gave platinum recording budgets to Mos Def and to Talib, and they still didn't go platinum.
That's very true.
Now, the label lost a shit ton of money on them by doing that, but they were kind of the proof that an artist with a bigger budget wouldn't necessarily go platinum, meaning you can't force music on people and think that they will buy it. They will listen to it, and they'll hear it on the radio, but it doesn't mean it's going to translate into sales or shows.
Yeah, it's funny. You actually hear Kweli talk about that. Yeah, you hear Kweli talk about that, actually, when he talks about his career and how things have changed a little bit differently. I've heard it mentioned in interviews why people don't understand that he was given, you know, million-dollar, you know.
Multi-million-dollar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, that just doesn't exist anymore. I mean, obviously, like, that's one case probably where the artist in that situation definitely benefited from all the dough that Raucous was putting into that label
God,
at the time.
It's and they're crazy. Doing it because the guy who owned it was just filthy rich, and he didn't mind taking the loss. He was doing it for the love instead of running it like a business, you know?
Right.
Consequently, Sony is still in business and Raucous is not.
Right.
So it's not
right.
hard to figure out who was right and who was wrong, you know? But I love that they existed because it kind of showed artists who were paying attention that just having a bottomless budget did not mean you were going to have bottomless success.
Mm-hmm.
And Common happened to be one of those artists who felt like if his budgets were better and he were making more money from the label, that he would be happier. And of course, the label didn't see his vision.
Well, that makes sense, actually.
To let him go.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it makes sense if you look at the Relativity releases. All the production was No ID and Doug Infinite. Right, there were no big producers on any of those records. They had like a couple of features here and there, like Black.
Well,
Thought.
His biggest record was "I Used to Love Her."
Yeah, exactly.
That was his big record
right. Exactly.
There.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And let's face it, it didn't. It was at a time when, if you put that next to you know, one of Biggie's releases that was multi-platinum, it's not hard to figure out what fans were looking for. You know, in comparison.
So you got him off Relativity and helped get him over to MCA?
I did not help him get his new deal.
Okay.
I kind of lost touch with him after he left Relativity. He didn't have enough leverage for me to help him get a great deal. The way that you get great deals is you go into the marketplace and you build a buzz that's so big, or you sell enough independent releases on your own that the label has to come in and give you more money than you're making on your own. And that's how you get a great deal. And I wasn't able, like, he didn't have enough leverage for me to be able to help him. You know, he wasn't in a position where I could have added value. So I let him kind of go on and do his own thing. And then a couple years later, or a year later, I think I heard that he had signed to Geffen. And he did really well at Geffen. Like, his music changed. He changed. He grew as an artist, and it was kind of a win-win for him.
Yeah, they let
and
him
he
bug
got
out.
Into film, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Hey, Wendy, you mentioned another artist that you had some dealings with, Eminem, and we were fortunate enough earlier in the year to interview one of your Rap Olympic athletes that you had on your team.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, this is a good one, Meeks. Man, you pulled that one out.
Yeah, was it Finale?
No, Thurston.
Thurston
Howell.
I'm tripping.
Third.
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah, we had a great interview with Thurston, and
he's so funny.
Yeah, he's wild. Like my favorite shit is the cooking show that he does. He's out here getting it right now with the Low Life clothing line and everything, and we support him major. But the Rap Olympic, can you talk about those times and how you put your team together and how was that kind of like a building block for what you were able to do within the industry?
Was it a building block? No. I would say that the building block for me really was Twista.
Okay.
And that was before Eminem.
Okay.
I tried shopping Eminem a deal. All of the labels knew who I was at that point in time. because of Twista. I had done his deal at Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And Twista had sold records on his own, so he had a lot of leverage when we did that deal. And at that point, I had been meeting with the presidents of the labels. We kind of skipped over A&R, the A&R departments, because he had so much leverage. He had sold, you know, a shit ton of music on his own. So we were meeting with the guys who could write the check on the spot and sign it. So I had great relationships. I started bringing Eminem's music to the labels, and they were just rejecting him. Mm. And while nobody had said it was because he was white, I kind of picked it up. I kind of figured out what the problem was.
Mm.
And I got really frustrated because, you know, back then it was the era of Vanilla Ice. And the labels were terrified. They didn't stop to think that the reason Vanilla Ice hadn't done well was because he wasn't real. He wasn't authentic.
Right.
You know, he was I call them prefabricated, like artists that are built to make music and sell records, as opposed to an artist who's actually great at what they do. No disrespect to Vanilla Ice.
I mean, well, it's Rob Van Winkle we're talking about, so.
Yeah.
I mean, but go ahead. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he just, as a rapper, he just wasn't seen as authentic, you know? So along comes me trying to shop a deal for Eminem in a climate where, you know, everybody was very anti
white rappers. Yeah.
And they were afraid.
Yeah.
They assumed that because they weren't rap fans at the label, they assumed that the backlash was because he was a white rapper.
Mm.
And I couldn't get him a deal to save my life. And it was really starting to piss me off because, you know, as we all know, he's incredibly talented.
Yes.
So at that point in time, there was a backlash against lyricists. The really smooth, LA music was coming in, you know, Dr. Dre, et cetera. The really smooth Biggie materialism, even though Biggie's lyrical, the music was becoming more about popping bottles and partying than it was about, you know, lyrical prowess.
Mm-hmm.
And I got frustrated about that as well. So I decided to do a battle and attract the major news outlets of the time, which is like, you know, BET, MTV,
right.
The Source, Rap Pages,
right.
Rap Sheet, like the people that kind of mattered as the tastemakers in rap, and bring them all to one place and let them see a battle. And I also kind of did it to showcase Eminem. I wanted people to see what I saw in him,
okay.
Was that he was this amazing battle rapper who could also write songs. And he had an EP out at the time, called Infinite, I think.
Yep.
And forgive me, my memory's not great, but I think
no, that's correct. No, yeah, that's it.
Yep. Is it? Okay, yes, good. I'm hoping you'll correct me if I'm wrong.
I'll correct you where I can.
You rock. You rock. You know, they all start to blend together at some
point. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm only right about 20% of the time, so you just happen to hit a good one there.
I just happened to catch it.
Exactly right.
Happened to catch it. So we did Rap Olympics, and it got covered amazingly. Like, the press really cared. They really gave a fuck that, you know, here are all these guys with these wonderful battle skills that were all coming together. And I loved doing it. It was wonderful to set up. I chose to do it in L.A. I did it during a music conference. I think it was on the last day of the music conference. I can't quite remember. It was a long time ago. And it just worked. And even though my team didn't win, Jay Smooth's team won. And the prize was... everybody got, they were bootleg, but they were Rolex watches, bootleg Rolex watches, really big at the time. The equivalent would be, you know, those hoverboards, the light up scooter thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. It would be like, if I did a battle today, if everybody got one of those, at the time. That's how big bootleg Rolexes were back then, right? So these guys were competing and they wanted it. Eminem was really cute because, you know, even though I kept saying it was bootleg, he's like, well, it might be real and I could sell it because he was homeless at the time. His goal was to win this Rolex, go home and sell it, and then use the money to live, right?
Right.
Very cute. But part of the prize was that the winning team would get to go on Sway and Tech onto the Wake Up Show.
Mm.
And I don't remember why Jay Smooth's team didn't go, but Sway and Tech invited my team instead. So my guys went up there and they did an interview and they were rhyming on air. And
yeah, Rec Shop.
Ray was in the car listening and he heard M rapping. He had also received a demo tape. I had sent demo tapes to Interscope like 3 times and got rejected all 3 times. But Jimmy's nephew was at the Rap Olympics, and I guess somebody had handed him a demo tape. So he went back to the office and was listening to it. And then Dre heard my team rapping on air, and he heard Eminem rapping on air. And he's like, oh, hell yeah. And then he signed Eminem, which is really a cool thing.
That sounds just like Dre, too. That was great Dre impersonation.
Much better than a Rolex, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But what's weird is it took forever for the album to come out. It took, like, years for the album to come out. It didn't come out until, like, what, 99 or 2000 or something? It just seemed to take forever.
Yeah, he was signed for a long time before he finally hit.
But see, that's what's so dope about this show, John, because my whole time, you know, thinking I've heard that Dre was kicking Eminem's demo tape around in his garage for like 6 months and finally picked it up and played it. And
yeah, I think I heard that story
too. Yeah, and that's not what happened. And we just got the true story right here.
Interesting.
Dope.
Wow.
So, and who all was on your team again, Wendy? Name them? Because was it a three man team or how many?
Words. You guys know who Wordsworth is, right?
Uh-huh.
Wordsworth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quest the Mad Lad.
Okay.
Oh, shit.
Eminem. Thurston Howell III.
Woo.
And I'm leaving somebody out. There was another person. It wasn't Juice.
It wasn't Juice?
Okay.
No, it wasn't Juice. Juice was there, but Juice had just won he was battling at the convention, and he had just won the convention's contest, or you know, the MC battle that they had, and he had been up on Sway and Tech like every weekend for like 6 months. So I didn't put him on my team because he was kind of obvious, like it was the obvious choice.
Yeah.
You know,
we got somebody we got somebody in here saying it was a white kid from Brooklyn that was on you. That was the one that you're missing.
No,
I think the only white kid on my team was Eminem.
Was him?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know. Who knows? Anywho.
I'm missing somebody, though. That's terrible. I know that Rhymefest was originally going to be on the team, and then something happened where he couldn't make it, and he was replaced by Quest the Mad Lad.
Mm.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, man.
That is wild. That's a great story.
Hell yeah.
It was amazing. You know, I took a wicked loss financially, and I lost like 10 grand over that. I had cash advance. My Visa, my MasterCard, my credit rating was in a crash for like 4 years over. So long
over Rap Olympics. Nice.
And it's funny because everybody says, why did you never do another one? And well, now you know
shit.
Why.
Broke as shit.
Hell yeah.
Hey, you were way ahead of your...
expensive.
You were way ahead of your time there, Wendy, with all the battles and shit that are popping now and all that stuff.
Yeah,
you were way ahead of your time there.
Definitely.
On that one. So, Wendy, what are you up to right now?
I'm still working with artists. I consult. You know, it's not profitable for artists anymore to sign to major labels, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
In 2005, the labels started doing 360 deals, and I just think 360 deals suck for artists. So I stopped doing major deals for artists, and I consult them on how to stay independent. I've built some really successful indie labels around the country. It's been really cool. Right now I'm working with an artist here in Atlanta called Trouble, who's blowing up in the Southeast, which is really a lot of fun. He was just on Young Thug's most recent mixtape with a song called Thief in the Night, which is getting a whole lot of love in the streets right now.
Okay.
But he's doing his thing. I'm proud of him. And then I'm working with an artist out of Phoenix, Arizona. He's a rapper called Mickey Zobel, who's exceptionally lyrical. and he's got a great sense of humor. So it's like, he's not a comedian rapper. I don't mean to imply that, but he's just fun to work with. He's just somebody that's, you know, he's very lighthearted. He's super lyrical, but he's smart enough to be able to dumb it down a little bit so that he doesn't lose his market. And he's just, he's been a lot of fun to work with as well.
So what do you, how does it work? Excuse me. These days, Wendy, with social media and like, how are you kind of hitting on all the, I guess, the requirements and the particulars now? Because it's obviously a lot different from, you know, the no limit deals and the budgets from back then, et cetera, et cetera. So
very, it's very different. I think the biggest difference is just the funding. Like the reason that most people signed to major labels back in the day was they needed the know-how, they needed the access, and they needed the money. Well, today there's so many people, you know, out here that have worked for labels that the know-how is really easy to find. It's easier to find an investor than it is to find a record deal. So the money's out here, and access, you know, the internet kind of opened everything up. You can upload, you can record an album in your home and upload it through TuneCore, you know, for, I don't know, $40 or $50, and you've got access, you know, to the whole world.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that you should, but it just means that you can if you have the desire to, you know, to be a rapper, as apparently 20 million people want to do.
Right.
Yeah.
I think today we have more rappers than we have fans.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
20 million sounds like a good number, though.
I think I might have lowballed it.
you could have.
Yeah, you know
I
what?
Think so.
You know what, Wendy? I like that. I like that. I guess saying, if you will, and actually, I think that applies in general just to the internet period. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
I had a conversation with someone the other day, and we with a friend of mine, and we both agreed that you should definitely have to take an IQ test. Or some sort of certification, something, before you can get any social media account, period. There should be some sort of qualification, some metric, something to measure your intelligence against before you get a Facebook account.
Yeah.
The world would be a much better place.
It would be a much better place, wouldn't it? I agree.
Yeah.
Speaking of,
it's a blessing and a curse. And, you know, as a marketer and promoter of rap music, it's also a blessing and a curse, because you can, if you utilize the internet properly and you engage people, you can really build fans relatively cheaply and relatively easily. Mm-hmm. The problem is so many artists don't know how to do that, so they just blitz out their music and send out video links like sporadically and constantly to people. Like, it's the equivalent of me walking down the street, some kid pulling up in a car and slapping me in the face with their CD and driving off. You know, and that's kind of what they're doing on the internet. But if they would take time to, like, engage people and tell them who they are and why they're different, you know, people would probably be more inclined to listen to their music and see if they like it. And if they like it, you know, they're a fan.
Interesting.
Yeah, we get the, our little podcast here even gets that, right, Meeks? I mean, how much shit do we get on Twitter or Instagram or somebody that obviously has not listened to the type of show that we do on Tuesday?
That's 100 a week.
It's easy. Crazy.
Yeah.
And we're at nobody. Least, yeah. We're nobody. Yeah. I bet it's even more.
It probably is.
I bet it's even more.
Yeah, but you know, you got those filters you can set, and I don't get a lot of
exactly.
That stuff.
You're a smart man. You're a smart man.
Wendy, you got any more?
But yeah, the internet has well, the one thing I just wanted to say about that was the internet has changed everything, but artists still need to get out into the real world and work their records. You know,
yes,
they
right.
need to, it's like politics. You've got to shake hands and kiss babies and take pictures with fat girls. It's
yeah.
just, it's what you have to do in order to build a fan base. You've got to interact and engage people both in person and on social media.
Right, right. That was so real. I think that's the realest thing I've heard on this podcast since we started this thing. Holy shit.
Oh, boy. Mm. Wendy, you got any more books on the horizon?
I do. I'm writing one now about how to make money with music, like, you know, how to start your own label.
Okay.
And I'm hoping to have it done. I'm hoping to launch it at South by Southwest this year in March.
Oh, fun.
I've
good.
Been writing it for 4 years. Just when I think that I'm done, it's like something else pops up and I go, oh God, I need to cover that.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to look more like a doorstop than a book,
right.
But it is coming. It is coming.
Okay.
What I saw, you mentioned TuneCore earlier. They're getting ready to launch an Atlanta office here, right? Are you?
I think they have.
Yeah.
I think they already have. I think they're on Edgewood now.
Yes, they are.
I think they've launched recently, like in the past month. And I haven't gone down there. I'm a huge fan of TuneCore. That's who I use for my clients, and they've always done right. They've always cut a check. They've always done, you know, what they say they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use their ancillary services.
Okay.
You know, they have promotion services, radio services.
Mm-hmm.
Those things have not worked for me in the past, but TuneCore as a distributor has been wonderful.
Okay.
Hey, Wendy, real quick, what's your view on the streaming game? You think you hear a lot of debates about whether artists are getting a fair shake. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that, you know, it's hard for any artist who signed to a label to say whether it's fair or not, because the deal that you have with your label is what dictates how much you're going to get paid. So,
sure.
You know, Spotify is on one hand saying that they're paying millions or billions of dollars to the major labels, and then you hear these artists like Taylor Swift saying, oh, I only got 18 cents, you know?
Right.
So I think the breakdown is on the label. Like, Spotify seems to be paying it, but it's not filtering down to the artist because of their, you know, whatever their lawyer negotiated at the record label. As somebody that works with indie artists, my artists get paid lovely.
Okay, so that's what
Spotify,
I was going to ask.
Pandora, from
right.
YouTube.
So what's the difference then? Like, so Taylor Swift gets paid 18 cents for a stream. What does an indie artist get for a stream if the deal's right?
I can't give you the exact amount because it's different for all of my artists. It just depends on how much they stream and when.
Okay.
But they might get like 90 cents compared to 18.
Oh, really?
Like,
okay.
That's a big difference, yes.
Can't
you know, it's interesting. I heard an interview with Consequence, or I believe it was Consequence, when he was making his promo run, 6 months ago, Meeks, even
mm-hmm.
when we interviewed him.
Yeah.
And it was the first artist I heard say this. He was like, look, he's like, better yet, don't go buy it, go stream it. And I thought that was
right.
kind of odd because I hadn't heard, you know, many
somebody
folks.
Actually pick it up.
Yeah, exactly, right. But I mean, if you're getting a buck every time somebody streams your song,
well,
hell
you're not.
Okay.
I was making a comparison, not giving you an exact
number. Oh, okay, I'm
number,
sorry. All right, I misinterpreted.
And I probably should have said that twice instead of just once.
Okay.
But I can't give you like exact numbers because it differs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something like, it would be something like 90 cents per 1,000 streams or per 100 streams.
Oh. Right, right,
so
right.
So
right.
The numbers are much lower than they are per sales, but
right.
you're getting listened to more times on
exactly.
Spotify than
right.
than you are getting. You get paid for an album one time,
right.
and that's it.
Right, exactly.
But
right.
you're getting paid on streams for the rest of the life of the fucking record.
Right.
So the streams have a more long-term value than short-term. And it's the direction that the world is going. Like, people are showing that they want to stream music. They don't want to own it. They don't want 20 gigs of music on their phone. They want to just
right.
stream it through Spotify or Pandora or whoever
mm-hmm.
and have access to their whole catalog for $10 a month.
I got to imagine, too, from an analytics perspective, when you're able to have data on who's playing your music and when it plays, like I got to imagine there's some, probably some intangibles
it's
there
awesome.
That you get with the streaming too, not just the how many pennies per stream are you getting and whatnot. There's got to be some intangible.
I can tell where somebody's streaming it from, like their zip code, their area, and then I can tell what they listened to before and after, so I can get a feel for like who my artist should be out on tour with.
Gotcha.
Yeah, you can't get that shit from somebody buying a record at the record
no.
store. Right,
no.
That's it. You don't know what else they bought or
you know,
what.
When you
right.
buy an album, like let's say you buy the new Adele album this week. I can't tell. Once you buy it, I can't tell how many times you listen to it. So I don't know if you listen to it once and you're like, mm-hmm. or if you listen to it every day for the next 7 years. I can't tell.
And she gave a big thumbs down.
I can tell.
Yeah, she gave a big thumbs down to the streaming.
Yeah, you
thing
can't
too.
Stream that album right yeah. now.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
She's
exactly.
straight physical copies, right?
She didn't give a fuck.
Okay, though. that was a shitty example, but you get my point.
Well, no, it's a great point.
It's an excellent point.
Great
actually.
Point,
yeah.
shitty example.
Yeah.
No, but it's great. I mean, it goes to show you like how big of an artist you would have to be to actually say, I don't need this, right? Because like a Taylor Swift exactly. is not going to need that. An Adele is not going to need that. But practically, you know, you could probably count the artists on your hand that don't need that extra data, if you will, about how their music is being consumed. There are very many.
And they get
them.
Frustrated with the sales. I know I have this argument with Tech N9ne all the time. Tech N9ne doesn't let any of his music stream for the first, I think it's 6 months, it might be 3 months, but he doesn't stream new albums. You have to buy it if you're a hardcore tech fan. Mm. But my argument is that, you know, there's so many ways to download for free that if somebody really wants your music and they don't want to pay $9.99 for it, they're going to find a way to get it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not trying to be funny, but you know, somebody emailed me the Adele album a week ago.
That's real.
So right. it's like, right. come on.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Well, Meeks, you have anything else? Oh, wait, I think we have a question from the audience, actually.
What's going on?
Okay. I think we have a question from, of course. Infamous. It's not a question about Michigan, though. So Wendy, my wife is here in the studio with us, and she wants to know what you do for fun in Atlanta.
Oh, I love that you asked that. You know, I watch a lot. I binge watch TV. You know, for the first 10 years, maybe 12 years that I was building my company, I didn't watch TV. I didn't really read books. Now I read a book a week. Okay. I watch a lot of TV. I have more free time as I've gotten older.
Okay.
I have a husband now of 3 years, and I spend a lot of time with him.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. We're both people that have big bellies. We like to eat. So, you know, we go to restaurants a lot, and we really just enjoy each other's company. Like, we do fun shit together. We go to cooking classes.
That's dope.
I take a lot of art classes because I love art. I love clay. Okay. I love glass. You know, I'm very artsy fartsy.
All right, so favorite restaurant.
A lot.
Favorite restaurant, Wendy.
Wow, that's a hard one. Geez. You know, I went to Mary Mac's last night, and I love Mary Mac's food.
Okay.
I had a really good time. That's in downtown Atlanta.
Yes.
I've never been there.
I enjoy Bacchanalia, which is like a higher end restaurant. That's like a $300 meal though, so that's not a place that I eat often. There is a little Indian restaurant that I don't know the name of, off of Metlock Bridge, that has really good food.
Okay.
You know, I live in the suburbs. I live in Alpharetta.
Yeah.
So I tend to spend a lot of time in the suburbs.
Right.
Okay. Which is kind of funny because I've always been a city girl.
Mm-hmm. Hey,
understood.
You know. All right. Very good. Meeks, what else you got, man?
I'm good, man. I'm so happy this happened, man, and
I'm so
it gives
happy
me
to be here. I gotta give you guys props for what you do, because there's no money in what you do. You're doing it because you love it.
Yeah.
And if more people would do that, the world would be a better place. So hats off to you for doing this.
Well, Wendy, I'm gonna tell you like this, and a lot of people. I don't think a lot of people that listen to this podcast realize that me and the homie John Doe, for a number of years, we're putting our foot out there on the music end of this thing. And we just started doing this podcast back in January of this year. I shit you not.
Good for you.
This has been the most, we've gotten the biggest response from this podcast than any music that we put out over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it just kind of, it just kind
of
makes sense to us right now. That's not to say that we're not going to do music anymore, because I'm sitting on a shit pile of beats right now from John that I really need.
Always.
But to be honest with you, I'm more interested in how I can continue, or how we can continue what we're doing with the Southern Vanguard Radio Show right now. It's just been that interesting for us, and we get to talk to people like you. So the shit is dope. You know what I mean?
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah,
that's
people
awesome.
Have stories
I love
to tell,
you
Wendy.
Love what you're doing.
Yeah,
you
know, people we're
have
having
stories
a good
to
time.
Tell.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't you have avenues
you
to
know
tell
what
their stories.
Tells you when you wake up and you say that you want to be an artist. Nobody ever tells you that you need at least $150,000 to market and promote yourself.
See,
regionally.
That's what the fuck
nationally.
I'm talking
I mean,
about right
regionally.
There. Because no one ever told me that shit right there.
No
and
one
I always,
told you that.
I've had people ask me that thinking that I had the money in my back pocket, you know, just looking at what we've done and what we've been able to do independently, asking me for a number, like, what would it take? Like, I want to put my little brother out. I'm like
$150 minimum.
I'm like, dude,
I can't do it for less.
I was telling them a million. You know what I'm saying? Like, you need $1 million.
Well, you kind of do if you're going to start a proper label,
right?
But to market and promote a release regionally, you know, that's just like in 5 to 7 states.
Yeah,
it's going to take you at least
$150,
if not more.
There it is,
and that doesn't include like T-shirts and stuff.
Right.
You know, if you want extras, you're going to pay extra.
Right.
But nobody tells us that. Like when we're starting, you know, there's this unspoken and unwritten thing where artists are either believe or are led to believe that if you're talented, it's enough. And somebody's going to discover you and put you on.
That hadn't been the case for a long time. Yeah. Wow.
And you know what's sad about that, though, is there's a bunch of artists sitting there in their homes right now thinking they weren't good enough because they didn't get discovered. And they're so much more talented than this rapper or that rapper or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, it's not about talent. It's about putting out your music independently like yourself and building enough of a buzz to attract somebody who can help you. To you.
Exactly.
Right.
And nobody's ever told that. So they think, wow, I didn't make it. I'm whack. Oh my God. That's so not true.
Right.
They
right.
could be the best artist in the world. They just didn't have a budget. It's heartbreaking.
Right.
Wendy, I have to imagine you have some pretty real conversations when you sit down with a client from Jump, right? I mean, you have to have a real come to Jesus
moment.
If
I'm sitting down with them, it means they have the talent. And that doesn't mean I like them. I work with a lot of artists whose music that I don't personally like. But what matters is what the fans think. It's not about me. I don't control this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taste is subjective. I don't like Kanye.
Yeah.
And the world loves him. I don't like Drake. And the world loves him. So I learned a long time ago, it's not about me. It's about the fans. You know, when I first worked with Bootsy and Webby, I didn't like their music, but I saw how it affected their fans. I saw millions of people loving their music.
Right.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Were you behind that? Did you work with Bootsy a good bit, Wendy?
I did. I stopped their deal in 2005. I didn't. I ended up not negotiating it. I didn't get them their deal at Asylum, and that's what happened. They wanted to, the label that's behind them wanted to sign to Asylum, and I just thought they could do better.
Yeah.
They didn't, so they took the deal, and I just couldn't help them do that.
So I have one more question for you before we wrap this up. Who do you think's doing it right now? Like, obviously, you're doing your thing with your artist, but, like, if there was a label or
Tech
an
nine.
Artist... Technology.
Absolutely.
Oh my God.
Absolutely.
When I get frustrated and I start to like lose my love for this, I go out to Kansas City and I spend a day with Travis or Tech and I get rejuvenated because they really get it. They do it right. They don't give a fuck about signing to a major. They don't give a fuck about fame. They own their own printing company. They own their own merchandise company. They own everything. They own all the trucks that they take out on the road with them. Like, they really get it.
That's what's up.
I got one more.
Guys that got a little bit of money and tricked it off at the strip club or bought rims for their car. These are guys that said, we've got money. Let's go buy real estate.
Exactly.
Let's go buy our studio. Let's go buy our office building. Let's go buy our T-shirt and poster supplier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
fucking brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got one more, Wendy, and I think we could shut this down. Out of all the artists that you dealt with, the deals that you brokered, all the tables you sat at, do you have any regrets?
You know, I don't. People ask me that a lot. It usually follows the cash money question because people know that I negotiated the cash money deal and had to sue them to get paid. But I don't. If I had it all to do over again, I would do the same thing because I feel like my goal has always been to get great deals for artists that have had leverage. And I've done that. You know, I've stuck to my mission and my goals. I haven't been swayed by money. I haven't been swayed by, you know, threats. I haven't been swayed by promises of trinkets and materialism. Like, I've always been able to accomplish what I've set out to do.
All right.
And I'm so thankful that I've gotten to walk this path. You know, when I first started my company, I used to ask myself, why me? Like, why am I doing this? Like, why should I do this? You know, why don't the artists do it for themselves? You know, why doesn't somebody who studied music or, you know, whatever do this? And around about maybe the third year, I realized, why not me?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, why not? I know that if I'm running this, that I can't be bought. I can't be persuaded to be unethical. I can't, you know, I'm going to do what's right regardless. I'm going to do what's fair regardless. So, you know, I've just kind of stuck to that for 23 years and proved that you can win when you do it right.
That's what's up.
So, yeah no regrets. I love what I do.
Cool. Well, Wendy, we are in Atlanta, and as big as the city is, it's really a small place. So if you find yourself in the midst of a bear hug, from a 6'7", 270-pound black man. It's me, Eddie Meeks. I know what you look like, so I will find you and I will hug you hard.
I can't wait.
And I can't wait to meet you. I know I got a feeling it's going to happen one day soon. So I really appreciate you being with
us
tonight.
I'm so honored.
Yeah,
no,
I'm
I
honored.
Appreciate this. I love what you guys do. I support you 1,000%.
Thank you so much.
Wendy, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Yeah.
Southern Vanguard Radio.
Get yourself together over there, homie.
I'm choked up.
Yeah.
At a moment. Wow, Meeks.
Yeah, man.
You pulled this one out, my man.
Hey, man, we got so much more.
Yes, we do.
I mean, you think the year is over. It ain't over,
No,
man.
It's not.
Part ain't over.
No, it's not. All right. So, Southern Vanguard Radio. DJ John Doe.
Cappuccino Meeks.
SouthernVanguard.com.
Yeah.
Instagram and Twitter. Southern Vanguard.
Yeah.
John Doe ATL.
Cappuccino Meeks.
We out of here. Stay tuned. Tuesday mix shows, Thursday interviews.
Yeah.
We're out here, y'all.
Peace.